for asking for this is to make it more in line with where Campbell should be. Campbell, the opinion creates a legal fiction. The legal fiction is that a prosecutrix is a witness whether she testifies or not. That is not true. A prosecutrix is only a witness if she testifies. But the Supreme Court, in order to allow hearsay statements in, created the legal fiction that a prosecutrix need not be a witness. So in order to make Campbell cleaner and to make this bill cleaner, we have tried to amend out the unavailability of the child witness so that the hearsay would only come in if the child testifies. In Campbell, what they said could come in is simply a statement that the event occurred, not who did it, and not any of the details. What you would have if this bill passed with this amendment is that if the child testified, then the corroboration, including the statement who did it and the details of the act, would come in. If the child did not testify, under Campbell, only the fact that the act happened would be admissible through hearsay, and it would have to be proven by other ways. So we think that that would be the optimum that we would ask for in an amendment to this bill. Going down to B and C, these are less, I guess, less damaging to the bill as far as it is now. If B is adopted, the hearsay statement would come in if the child's not available. Incompetence and lack of memory would not be grounds for unavailability. C would delete incompetence, in other words, add lack of memory back in as a ground for unavailability. So if the child lacked memory, then the child could be declared unavailable, and the hearsay would come in under that. Now for D, D is an alternative to B and C, or in connection with B and C, and it's also in connection with the National Legal Resource Center. It would add in the language, and I've seen this happen in several cases, where the child simply persists in refusing to testify, either because of fear or for reasons that cannot be directly gleaned from the record. So and this is conceptual, we haven't really figured out where to put this in yet, but if the child persists in refusing to testify because of fear or some related reason despite repeated judicial requests to do so, then the child could be declared unavailable and the hearsay statements would come in, including not just the fact that the event occurred, but including the fact of who did it and the details as listed in the bill. So those are the amendments that we're proposing. I'm certain that there'll be some opposition.
John, you want to respond?
Yes, Senator Cohen, members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm John Collins, Yamhill County District Attorney. I didn't have a lot of time to consider these, but as I read them while we're waiting for this bill to be called, I would analyze it this way. The bill can basically be divided in half, if you will. There are two pieces to the bill. One piece is where the child is available as a witness, and the other piece is where the child is not available as a witness. And both pieces are important to the obtaining a just result in these cases. I would say, I mean, this is perhaps just my individual judgment, but I would suggest that the weightier portion of the two halves is the one where the child is unavailable. That's the one that's most important. I would also point out, again, that in the case where the child is unavailable as a witness, the bill requires corroboration of the, not only of the sexual conduct, but of, as we've agreed, the defendant's involvement in that conduct. So basically, you would have a situation, not unlike Campbell, where the defendant had confessed and prosecution, I mean, there's some other twists to that particular case, but basically prosecution was greatly impaired, even in the face of a confession by the defendant, because the child was unavailable as a witness, and there was no independent, because of that, corroboration of the confession. The half where the child is unavailable as a witness, I think is a very important half, and the DAs would strongly recommend that the committee not remove that half from the bill. And again, as looking at it from an overall justice standpoint, I would emphasize that we've gone further than perhaps the ABA model bill suggests we need to, and that is by requiring corroboration of the act and the defendant's involvement. So there are protections, and the case that proceeds with the unavailable child will be limited to those where there's independent corroboration.
Chair, John, for the Roman numeral two amendments, you mentioned that they were a result of a compromise reached. What was that, the compromise with the defense bar?
Yes, Senator Hill, that's reference to the three of us meeting with legislative counsel.
Committee counsel.
Right. Committee counsel. Thank you.
Okay, other questions with respect? I would, the committee needs to seriously contemplate these things before we come into work session next time. And I would admonish people to understand what they're doing here. If you don't know, come talk to Jack. Go talk to the people who are the three people who are out here prepared to respond to questions or comments. And I think we need to encourage folks to figure out where they personally need to be so that we can attempt to move this bill next time we meet in without a prolonged going over things. Again, we need to do a little homework, folks. Corey.
Madam Chair, one additional comment respecting Amendment D as proposed by the OCDLA. We would object to substituting that for the other grounds of unavailability, but frankly, it looks to us like a good addition. That is, the bill currently would state that a witness is unavailable if the witness has a substantial lack of memory or is incompetent to testify, but another substantial ground of unavailability might be this situation in which the child refuses repeated judicial requests to testify. The House passed version of the bill, and I believe this was discussed briefly at a prior hearing, included as a standard for unavailability when the child was in fear. I personally believe that that goes too far. The fact that the child is in fear in and of itself does not make the child unavailable as a witness. But where the child's fear rises to such a degree where the child simply refuses to testify under any circumstances, even though the child has a memory and is technically competent, in my view, that would be an additional reasonable ground of unavailability.
Thank you, Corey. Anyone else just finally make a comment or question of the people we have before us here before we close this issue down? Thank you. Senator Shoemaker has to go to labor.
Yep, I have to miss
I am not certain what the committee's wish is, whether we ought to have people move into the next bill, which is 516 amendments. I think we do need to do that for the next. Do we have 10 minutes, folks? I mean, I know you don't, Senator Shoemaker, but unless they're involved in work session, I'd like to get it on the table and know where we are.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Senate Bill 516 is perhaps even the more complicated of the two of these bills. It deals primarily with allowing closed circuit television testimony and videotape depositions in child sex abuse cases. It also provides a statutory scheme for screening the defendant from the alleged victim in those cases where it's deemed appropriate. You'll find in your file, again, some proposed amendments. They're entitled Proposed Amendments to Senate Bill 516, March 1989. Again, there is a hand-engrossed version. That version incorporates Roman numeral 1, which are the agreed-to amendments, and I'll go over those briefly, and then we can move on to the amendments proposed by both OCDLA and ODAA. The First Amendment, you'll find on page 3, line 17, 16 and 17, notwithstanding the limits contained in subsection 18A of this section, in any proceeding in which a child under 10 years of age We've inserted the language at the time of trial. I think the parties agreed that 10 years of age in and of itself was somewhat vague. We didn't know if it meant at the time of the incident, at the time of the statement, or at the time of the trial. And because this deals basically with trial procedure, it was felt that the age at the time of trial was the most significant. Page 3 as well, line 21 and 22, there's an amendment which adds the language established by expert testimony. Because we're dealing the criteria is whether the child will suffer severe emotional or psychological harm. All the parties agreed that it was best to have a requirement that expert testimony be brought in to support that, rather than simply have the parties, the two attorneys with a limited knowledge of psychology, come in and try to hash that out in front of a judge. It just seemed appropriate that when we're talking about these significant of changes, that an expert be required.
Doesn't show where
testimony will be allowed as provided in this subsection only if the court finds that there is a substantial likelihood established by expert testimony that the child will suffer severe emotional or psychological harm.
There's no period at the end.
Correct. And those were the two agreed to amendments. Roman numeral 2, you'll see some amendments proposed again by OCDLA, and Roman numeral 3 are the amendments that are proposed by ODAA by way of Mr. Connors. I've referenced the amendment sheet that I've typed up. I've referenced to a sheet entitled Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association Robert Reed Amendments, and then the material submitted by Mr. Collins, which has his amendment. And I should mention finally that with respect to the amendment submitted by Mr. Collins, I mis-summarized that. If you look on the first page, that should say amendment would provide that only the DA or the child rather than the court. And that's my fault. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Do we have any comments with respect to at least Roman numeral 1? and if there are none, just go ahead and offer your own, the amendments that are, and why don't you start, John?
Yes, Senator Cohen, members of the committee, and I'll be brief. The amendments proposed in Roman numeral 1, I think, are all reasonable and ones we've agreed upon with defense counsel. Would you want me to go on to address?
Please. Yeah.
The amendments that the District Attorney's Association has proposed, I've submitted a written testimony, and the explanation for that amendment, I think, is addressed in that testimony. I can summarize it by saying, candidly, the DA's support for the deposition of witnesses concept is somewhat tenuous. However, if we believe that the deposition would be on motion of the district attorney or perhaps on motion of the child, then it would not interfere with our ability to prosecute a case. If it is on motion of defense attorney, it's our position that, frankly, the whole concept will end up being used as a weapon against the child rather than something meant to help those children that have such difficulty testifying in court. If it's on motion of the defense can then force the child to submit to psychological examinations, psychiatric examinations, for purposes of supporting their motion for a deposition. And then if they're further successful in doing that, they could force the child through a depositional process of confrontation with the offender that is probably going to be more traumatic than the trial itself, because the deposition would be taken generally in a smaller room, the defendant would be there at a closer range, defense counsel is less likely to be polite to the child because he won't be in the presence or vision of the jury. There's a number of reasons why we think that the deposition could be used to intimidate the child and end up hurting the child more than the testimony at trial itself. Another piece of that is that from the state standpoint, in these types of cases, almost invariably the state's strongest piece of evidence, if you will, is the child who testifies live and in court, looks the defendant in the eye, looks the jury in the eye, and tells them what happens. And if the defense has the ability to force the state into substituting a deposition, it seems to me that the state loses and the jury loses and the courts lose an important piece of evidence. And then finally, just as a matter of policy, it's the state's position that we're the one that's calling the child and we're the one that's advocating. If anybody's advocating on behalf of the child, it's the state, not the defendant. And it is the state that should have the ability to determine when the circumstances are so dire as to substitute a deposition for live testimony.
Okay.
Could I ask? Yes, John, so you're saying that you don't like using depositions really at all? Or is your amendment, I mean, I'm trying to, is your Roman numeral 3 amendment just a reaction to the defense bars wanting to use depositions, or if you had your way, would you not like to have them used at all, or is it?
I think that if the amendment is adopted, it narrows the application of the deposition concept to those limited number of cases where, in fact, the child would be extraordinarily, or I think that's not the exact words of the statute, but it would involve some severe psychological damage to the child if the child were called. And as long as it's narrowed to that type of case, then we would support that. It may, in fact, allow us to proceed with a case we couldn't otherwise proceed upon. And, of course, that's something the state regards as favorable. But if the deposition concept applies to virtually all cases, or if the defense has the ability to force the child into examinations and depositions, we don't think that's in either the interests of the state or the child. So to answer you as directly as I can, Senator Hill, we support the bill if amended, and we would not if it were not amended.
So that's how important your amendment 3 is to you?
Yes.
Okay. And I think we're all clear on what they mean to say by their amendment or their offered amendment. Okay. Then let's go ahead. Cora, do you want to comment on that? Or
Madam Chair, I'd like to offer a brief comment on that amendment if I could.
Yes.
And that is to say that the description that Mr. Collins just gave was in fact our intent in proposing this bill. This is not an attempt to submit a child to discovery depositions. This is an attempt in those rare cases where courtroom testimony would be very harmful to the child to allow an alternate mechanism. It's not intended to be game playing. It's not intended to let the defense counsel either take the child out of the courtroom or subject the child to additional proceedings when they're not necessary. For us, the important part is that the child can request the advocate for the child that this procedure take place in the circumstances where there would, in fact, be severe harm to the child. We wouldn't expect it to be used routinely. We would expect it to be used as a substitute for courtroom testimony only in that narrow group of cases, so we do support the DA's amendment.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Groom.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We continue to oppose this bill in its entirety. We oppose the amendment submitted by the District Attorneys Association, and I'll speak in connection with our amendment, Roman numeral 2, sub A. We're moving to amend that the depositions not be allowed at all. In 1985, on the House side, the defense lawyers attempted to pass a bill which would have allowed for depositions in criminal cases. It was strongly opposed by the District Attorneys Association and went down in flaming defeat. We don't think that there's necessarily needs to be an area carved out of the criminal law where all of a sudden in this one rare instance depositions are allowed. It presents defense counsel who is trying a case with a distinct problem. You prepare for trial, and if deposition is a part of a preparation for trial, then the witness will be deposed long before trial begins. Trial begins, and the district attorney has complete control over which witnesses to call in what order. If the deposition is not played first, then defense counsel will be in the position of having to listen to the tape and cross-examine during the deposition without benefit of what the first witnesses are going to say. In other words, if the deposition is played in the place of the victim, and that would be the fourth witness, there are three witnesses that have already testified, defense counsel will not have benefit at the time of the deposition of knowing what those three witnesses are going to say during their testimony during trial. So therefore, there is no way to combat or to have knowledge of how the trial is going to be going by the time the deposition's played. So we oppose using the depositions in any way during the trial. I suppose there's a chance that it could be saved if it was required that the deposition be played first, if it was required by the DA to play that first, but we would still oppose it. But that would be the only way I think it could be saved constitutionally. And that includes my comments on both the DA's amendment and Roman numeral 2 sub A. If you're ready to move on to sub B of our amendments, I can
yes,
do that.
Yes, go ahead with yours. And then I do want to get to Loretta Clark, who has come from...
The portion of the bill that we find most offensive is what we call the screening portion, which begins at line 28. Evidently, what the bill would do is, if the court makes certain findings that there's going to be trauma, this is paraphrasing it, the court could arrange to have a screen or some type of barrier put up so that the person who is testifying, the victim, does not have to be seen by the person against whom that testimony is offered. We think that is blatantly unconstitutional in violation of the Confrontation Clause, not only of the U.S. Constitution, but of our own Oregon Constitution, which requires that the witnesses face the defendant face-to-face. I'd like to point out that Coy versus Iowa was decided under the U.S. Constitution, and I want to read just one paragraph, a very short paragraph, from that opinion, and the opinion is by Justice Scalia, who was appointed by Reagan and is hardly a flaming liberal. In that case, the screen was put up, and the Supreme Court said that face-to-face presence may, unfortunately, upset the truthful rape victim or abused child, but by the same token, it may confound and undo the false accuser or reveal the child to be coached by a malevolent adult. It is a truism that constitutional protections have costs. And I'd urge the committee to seriously consider that in considering this bill. There would be profound constitutional problems and very costly litigation if it is permitted for a defendant to be screened off from the victim. You might just as well hang a sign over the defendant saying, "This man is guilty," as far as the jury is concerned.
Senator Cohen, could I respond to that briefly?
Please, Chair.
Thank you. That particular sentence, I think counsel's right in that it relates to the Coy case, but I'd like to distinguish the case. In that case, if you read the whole, the entire case, including the dissents, you'll get the idea that what the court is saying is that the legislature cannot presume that the child will be emotionally harmed and therefore allow screens in every case, that it takes some finding by the court of severe emotional or psychological harm, and that's provided for in this bill. That's why the DA's Association takes the position that, though that phrase does relate to the Coy case, we've provided for what the Coy case says you have to provide for. Pardon my grammar.
Okay. Corey?
Madam Chair, one very brief additional comment. The language in the bill does not actually use the word screen, and I would just like, and there is, of course, a due process issue, which I believe the OCDLA representative is referring to when he says hang a sign saying guilty, there would certainly be some physical setups that might violate due process by indicating guilt on the part of the defendant, putting him in a box or some visible means of saying this is a person who's too disgusting to look at. But this bill would permit something as simple as having the witness in a chair facing the jury with the defendant in another chair that's over the shoulder instead of face to face. In other words, the witness would have his or her back to the defendant.
Why can't you do that part now?
Madam Chair, I believe it's possible that you can do it now. The bill would clarify that the judge has flexibility in making courtroom arrangements. I'm not sure that under current law you couldn't put a screen up, an unobtrusive screen that satisfies the due process clause now. The bill would certainly clarify that and, in fact, might add some protection to the defendant in requiring the findings of psychological harm before allowing out of the ordinary, unusual courtroom arrangements.
There you go.
Madam Chair, I'd like to get back to the issue of the pointing of the deposition. Dave, you said that there is a constitutional problem in having that played, say, out of in some order other than first?
Well, I can't think of a real, a section of the Constitution other than your basic right to a fair trial due process argument that if it was played later, the defense counsel would not have knowledge as to what the previous witnesses had testified to at the time the deposition was taken. It would be difficult to prepare a defense under those circumstances. I don't have a specific portion of the Constitution I can point to on that except for the due process clause.
Madam Chair, if I could address that, I'm certainly not prepared to say that portion of the bill is unconstitutional, but it has occurred to me that a challenge could be mounted on the basis of the confrontation clause in the sense that If the deposition system were used, that it may impinge upon the defendant's right to effective cross-examination because of the reason stated that you wouldn't be able to cross-examine after hearing the other evidence, or for that matter, the opening statements of counsel at that point. So that is a possible challenge. Whether it's successful or not, who knows? But,
Madam Chair. Then I'd like to ask John, what is the problem? Would there be a problem in playing the deposition as the first bit of testimony?
Senator Cohen, Senator Hill, I don't think so, though I'm not sure that addresses counsel's concern. I think if I hear Mr. Groom, he's talking about the child is basically deposed and you ask about questions A, B, C, and then at trial question D and E come up. And there's the defense counsel without an ability to talk to the child about ABC. That type of a situation might be remedied if the court had discretion to basically reconvene the deposition. That's something that might be procedurally awkward, but could be done.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, I'm not sure that the problem is really as severe as it might sound like. In one of the fairly well-established hearsay exceptions in the case of witness unavailability is prior recorded testimony. That is testimony at which there has been an opportunity to cross-examine, but in the context of some other proceeding or some other situation in which the witness was under oath. That has, as I understand it, always been held to satisfy the right to cross-examination, even though the cross-examination was not in the context of prior witnesses who testified in that particular trial.
Okay, Senator Hill?
Well, I'd just like to have it as clean as possible. That's my only concern. Whatever language would do that.
I heard a number of people testify on this that one of the main concerns, of course, is trauma to the victim. And I think if you talk about reopening a deposition, that certainly reopens the trauma again. And getting back to what Justice Scalia says, some of these things just bear the cost. The constitutional requirement bears the cost, and the cost here is that we're talking a situation where the family is already completely traumatized. It's not like the courtroom scene is the cause of the trauma. The trauma has occurred, and the courtroom scene undoubtedly exacerbates that, but still It is a requirement of the Constitution that the person be made to testify. But keep in mind, of course, that if the Senate the sentencing guidelines bill passes, the sex offenders are going to be the ones that are going to be going to prison for the longest periods of time. I'd like to think that nobody innocent is going to be going to prison for a great period of time simply because of the passage of this bill.
Madam Chair, the one thing I would add is that I've included in your files a copy of the Coy case. The committee may want to review that. I think everyone recognizes that there are probably, successful or not, going to be constitutional challenges to a number of the portions of these bills. I guess the one section that I do feel at least somewhat comfortable in telling the committee that it's my opinion that it's unconstitutional is that portion of 516 having to do with screening of the defendant. I think that's what COI holds, although as Mr. Collins has pointed out, it can be successfully distinguished. Nevertheless, that's a holding. I also think that would be the finding under that line of cases having to deal with due process challenges. For instance, the jail code in place cases that say if a person is identified by jail clothing, it's an unconstitutional impingement on his right to a fair trial. Keeping in mind that